Jeff, I want to ask you to hold on for a moment because we're going to bring into the conversation two women who are intimately involved with the Timothy Cole case. The first is Ruby Session. She is the mother of the late Timothy Cole. And the second is Michelle Mallon. She is the rape victim whose testimony helped to convict Cole back in 1986. Ruby, Michelle, thank you both for coming on News and Notes.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Ruby, let me begin with you. Timothy was your oldest son. Tell us what it was like visiting him in prison all of those years, believing that he was, in fact, an innocent man.
We always knew he was innocent. Timothy knew that, too. It was very, very hard to go to see him and then leave, coming back to Fort Worth, knowing that there were some things going on that were not conducive for his health.
How did he handle it? What did he say to you when you would go visit?
His main thing was, I want to be exonerated and totally vindicated from this crime. And he couldn't understand why Michelle picked him out. He didn't live to hear from her and from Jeff and all those others who are working on the case as to how she could have picked his picture out. That's another story, because in the lineup, the pictures taken from police files, TM's picture was a Polaroid picture. And the description of the rapist for Michelle did not match my son in any shape, form, or fashion.
Well, let me stop there to bring Michelle into the conversation. And Michelle, we appreciate your coming on. I'd like to start with this. You were the victim of a brutal rape on March 24th, 1985, in a Lubbock, Texas church parking lot. In all those years since the trial, did you ever doubt that your identification of Timothy Cole was accurate?
I never doubted it. I honestly was shocked when I found out on May 21st of this year when George White from the Lubbock DA's office contacted me. I mean, I thought he was getting out of prison. I didn't know he died 9 years ago. So, no, I never had any doubt. And in my mind, I really honestly believed that they had found the right guy. I thought that, you know, they didn't tell me their evidence. I just assumed they had other forensic evidence, and it looked to me like, I mean, I really honestly believed he was the one.
Have you been able to ask yourself how, even though you were convinced that he was the one, that it turns out, if the DNA evidence is correct, that he, in fact, was not the one?
Have I what now?
Have you ever been able to figure out or ask yourself how you could have come to the wrong conclusion?
I've asked myself that 1,000 times ever since I got that phone call in May. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, unless I was just so traumatized or something, I don't know. I really don't. I really honestly believe that it looked like him to me. It really did, and I thought that was him.
Now, Ruby, tell us about the day that you found out about the DNA results.
Jeff Blackburn called one of my sons and I about 8 o'clock on a Friday night and said that the DNA come back, and it was this guy in Snyder, Texas. And we celebrated a little bit, but we were cautiously optimistic until the final results came in. So it's bittersweet, but we're just hoping that a judge somewhere here in the state will let Jeff have this hearing.
Now, we're going to ask both of you to hold on. In a moment, we're going to take a break, and I want to talk about the fact that you, Michelle, and you, Ruby, for the first time last Friday, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yes.
So we're going to talk about what that meeting was like. Jeff, you're still there?
I sure am.
Really quickly, is there a time frame at all that's involved in moving this forward?
Well, it's going to be up to the judge. The best we can do is bring it to the attention of the courts now in Travis County. We plan on filing this petition on Thursday. And after that, it's going to be up to the system itself to see if they're willing to rectify this horrible, horrible, tragic error.
If you are successful, it would be, would it not, the first time in the history of the state of Texas that someone who has been convicted of a crime was exonerated posthumously.
That's correct.
All right, hold on. Like we said, we're going to come back and continue this conversation with both of you, with all three of you. We're talking with Jeff from the Innocence Project. We're talking with Ruby Session, the mother of the late Timothy Cole. We're also speaking with Michelle Mallon, who was the rape victim whose testimony sent him to prison back in 1986. This is News and Notes. We'll be right back. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back with Jeff Blackburn, chief counsel for the Innocence Project of Texas. He is leading the effort to posthumously exonerate Timothy Cole. Ruby Session is Cole's mother, and Michelle Mallon is the rape victim whose testimony sent Cole to prison. She is now helping to clear his name. Welcome back. Let me begin with you, Michelle and Ruby. This is a tragic situation, and there are victims all around. But for the mother of a man who died in prison and who was convicted wrongly, and for a victim of rape who was a part of sending that person to prison, for the two of you to meet for the first time face-to-face just last Friday must have been an emotional moment. Ruby, was it?
It was. I had talked to her about a month ago on the telephone, and I was anxious to see her. I have no animosity now, never have. Did the family have any animosity towards Michelle? We said she had been raped, but we all knew that it was not Timothy. She had our sympathy, but in meeting her last Friday, she had apprehension, saying that she, in her mind all the way over from the airport, that she thought how we might dislike her, hate her even. And so I tried to dispel all those fears by letting her know that she was victimized just as my son was, and we never had any animosity toward her. So I tried to reassure her that we never said, never doubted that those things did not happen to her. But the only thing was that we knew for certain is that my son did not do it because of the way the arrest went down and then the way the trial was conducted.
Well, so let me bring Michelle in. Michelle, how apprehensive were you about meeting Ruby and the family?
Well, I was just kind of, I mean, when I first found out about it on May 21st, I mean, my first reaction was, oh my gosh, his family probably hates me. That was just what I thought. And I thought, you know, I never dreamed they would want to even talk to me or see me or anything. And then I get this, you know, email from Sarah Hagee from the, she sent it to my cousin in Abernathy, and then my cousin forwarded it to my mom, and my mom forwarded it to me and saying that the family was, you know, she sent me in the email Corey, the youngest brother's cell phone number, and saying that they would love to talk to me and all this stuff. And I was just shocked. I never dreamed that. So, I mean, because I just assumed they probably just couldn't stand me, and as, you know, as they had every right to, and as, in my eyes. And I was very apprehensive on Friday. I was scared that, you know, I was just nervous.
Where did this meeting take place, and how long did it last, Michelle?
It was at Corey's house, Timothy's youngest brother's.
And how long were you there?
I don't know. I guess an hour and a half. I don't know, a couple. It seems like it was a couple hours, an hour and a half to 2 hours. I don't know.
So when you left, when she left, let me ask you, Ruby, did you feel that you had made an important connection that would help Timothy?
I was just happy to know that she would come and meet us. The most important thing in that meeting was for us to let her know that we had no hard feelings toward her, because she had nothing to ask our forgiveness for, and I was just happy that the story was out. But before I finish, I'll just say this. We took Michelle to the cemetery so that she could see where Timothy is buried and let her have some moments to say whatever she had to say to him along the lines of the things that she had said to us when we first met.
Our time is running short, and let me bring you back in, Jeff, for one last comment, and it's this. When you have the victim who is now recanting and who is supporting the efforts to have Timothy Cole exonerated, we have less than a minute for your answer. Is that not enough to get the court of inquiry that you're looking for?
Well, it should be. We've already found moral redemption. Now we need legal redemption.
And you're hoping that that's going to happen?
I'm still enough of a believer in the court system, even in Texas, to think that somewhere, someplace, there's a judge who's willing to say what's right is right and what's wrong is wrong.
Michelle, thank you very much for coming on. We appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And the same to you, Ruby. Thank you for coming on as well. It's a fascinating story that you all have to tell.
Thank you very much.
Jeff Blackburn is the chief counsel for the Innocence Project of Texas. He is leading the effort to posthumously exonerate Timothy Cole. Ruby Session is Timothy Cole's mother. Her son was wrongfully convicted of rape, dying in prison while serving his sentence. And Michelle Mallon is the victim of rape whose testimony sent Timothy Cole to prison. She is now helping with the formal efforts to have his name cleared.
Today we wrap up our month-long housing series with a look at something that's been on our minds a lot. We're talking about the mortgage crisis and how it's affecting our friends, families, country, and ourselves. According to the Federal Reserve, 1 in 7 American homeowners owes more on their house than it's worth. That puts millions of people at risk of foreclosure. And there are a lot of opinions as to why this is happening. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from a California real estate and lending expert, but first, a national perspective on the foreclosure crisis. Thomas Martin is president of America's Watchdog, a national housing consumer advocacy group. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what exactly does it mean to have your home foreclosed on?
Well, in a nutshell, it means you haven't been making your mortgage payments. You're upside down as far as payments, and the bank's taking the property back. And it's all, you know, based on the contract you signed in the deed or the note.
How far behind in payments do you have to be before they really go after you on a foreclosure basis?
It depends on the loan servicer or the lender itself, but in subprimes, it could be as low as 3 months and they start foreclosure. Mainstream banks, because of politics, and they're trying to hide the truth from the shareholders, it may be 6 to 8 months or even more.
Now, do you think African Americans and Latinos are disproportionately affected by this whole mortgage shakeout?
Well, everyone was affected. I mean, all genders, all races, all ages, but blacks and Spanish speakers, absolutely yes. One being the blacks, I think, you know, they were in certain city neighborhoods frequently, and they had a lot of sudden equity or instant equity in their homes. And so people just took advantage. The industry targeted them. I mean, we've seen case after case where people are receiving letters saying they can get $10,000 or $15,000, no credit checks, no appraisal, no nothing. They bit, not realizing that the loan, when I reviewed the papers, cost them $30,000 or $40,000.
Tom, when you talk with people, and you've talked with thousands of homeowners across the country, what are they saying about both how they got into this mess and, are they hopeful of getting out, or are most of them fatalistic?
I think pretty fatalistic at this point. I think the clock's hit 12 and people are realizing I'm in deep trouble and I need to get out. And what terrifies us is that our National Mortgage Complaint Center has projected that by this time next year, 1 in 4 U.S. homeowners will own more in their house than it's worth. And what mortifies us is the fact that they walk. We'd be worried about a lot more than just a recession right now.
Do you think there's going to be a government bailout of not of institutions as we've seen already, but of individual homeowners?
I was a victim of, I was in Katrina, and, you know, that was 80,000 houses. They did a horrible job on that, so we're terrified the fact that the government will come in too late in the game to stop any foreclosures, spend a bunch of money, and really not get the desired result. And the issue is so complex, you know, the whole spectrum of buyers are out there. People have put nothing down, home flippers, et cetera. We're not exactly sure how the government does a bailout.
We are used to hearing about people who have lower-priced homes and overextended themselves and maybe had subprime mortgages, but now you're seeing a trend of some people who have fairly pricey homes getting into trouble. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, we think it was an embellishment. You know, the numbers that the industry is releasing right now, we think, are dramatically lower than what they actually are. I think I've seen numbers of 5,000 or 7,000. If you really throw in the high-rise...
We're talking about homes worth at least $1 million.
Oh, yeah. If you throw in the high-rise condos in Miami-Dade, throughout the country, L.A., with these million-dollar-plus houses, we're probably looking at 25,000 to 35,000 foreclosures just within the next 12 months. So six times the numbers I've seen, five or six times.
Where are the hot spots? Where are... You mentioned Miami's condo overbuilding. Where else are there real trouble spots?
Southern California is going to detonate in the next 12 months, and that's going to be the big problem for the country because the price thresholds of houses are so high in Southern California or Northern California that, you know, it's like four houses in Ohio. And if they go, we think we'll start seeing bank failures.
Well, I'm in Southern California, and every time I walk down my street, I see some other place for sale. It's definitely something that you can literally see on the streets. So if you're someone who's not in foreclosure but who knows that things are really tightening up, what advice would you have for that person?
Well, we get probably 15 to 30 phone calls a day on that one, and we just tell people consult an attorney. You know, find out what your best legal avenues are because – we are not attorneys, but certainly we're trying to tell people the foreclosure is still going to happen. So you may have to go bankrupt if that's the appropriate avenue. A short sale, which means to sell the property before you even get for it and give it to the bank and hopefully walk away, or even, in fact, go deed in lieu, which just means you walk into the bank, put the keys on the counter, and just walk away.
Thomas, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thomas Martin is president of America's Watchdog, a national housing consumer advocacy group. And let's focus now on a state with one of the biggest foreclosure problems in the country. We're talking California. Last month, one in every 200 California households received a foreclosure notice. That is 2.5 times the national average. For a closer look at how you can keep a hold of your home, we've got Nancy Harris. She's been in the real estate and lending industry for more than 20 years, and she owns Harnan Financial Group in Los Angeles. The company helps people locate, finance, and buy property. Welcome.
Good morning.
So we just heard a little bit about bankruptcy. Is that really an option for people?
Bankruptcy is an option for certain people depending on their specific situation. The trouble is that with real estate and just individuals in general, every scenario is specific and subjective. So what may be good bankruptcy for one person, that may be a good option. For others, it may not.
Give us a story. You've dealt with so many different people, but give us a story of a client who was facing foreclosure, but you managed to save him or her. Just generalities about it.
Yes, this is just funny. This just happened just a week or so ago. A client called me and wasn't really sure how bad their situation was. So luckily I was able to get the paperwork and any public records that were filed against the property. And to my horror, and this is the truth, the day that I looked at the paperwork, their house was going to be sold on the courthouse steps in about an hour from when I was looking at the paperwork. So what I did was call the client, apprise them of what was going on, and did they realize they were literally about to lose their house, it was going to be sold from under them in about a half hour. I called the trustee company who was in charge of the sale, spoke with them, got them in touch with the client, and long story short, they were able to wire some money in time to prevent that sale from going on the steps of the courthouse. But, I mean, that's an extreme case, but this is the stuff we're looking at.
Do you think people procrastinate because they just can't face talking to anyone, including people at the bank, about it, or they're ashamed.
That's a huge part of it. People stick their heads in the sand, don't open the mail, because the banks and lenders go through a lot before they actually take your property. They are trying to communicate with you. And so a lot of it is, again, shame, embarrassment, and people just don't want to deal with it.
You've been in the industry for 20 years. How have things changed, and do these things go through cycles?
Absolutely, and that's some things that people have to remember. This is all cyclical. Now, every cycle takes a different type of personality, and this cycle is taking yet a different personality and a pretty painful one. But you always have ups and downs in real estate, and that's what people have to realize. Real estate basically is a long-term investment. It is not a short-term, use your house as an ATM investment. It's a long-term investment. When you go against those principles, you have to understand what you're getting into. You run the risk of getting in markets where your investment goes down, just like the stock market. Your investment goes down, what can you do?
Now, how many of your clients would you say have had subprime loans? How big of it is a problem is it for people who you've dealt with?
Well, I would probably say of my portfolio, anywhere from 25 to 30% of my portfolio over the last, I would say, 5 years was in subprime loans. And, you know, this is my personal opinion, but it the loan itself is not the problem. It's the understanding that the client had of what they were getting themselves into. For instance, my clients, I told them, I said, you know, you're going to be paying this now, but in the change, you're going to be paying this. Can you afford it?
You also sell real estate. Some people are saying now is the perfect time to buy, or 6 months later, or this, that, or the other. If you think that you're in a position to buy, what should you do, and is it a good time?
If you're in a position to buy, meaning that you have some money saved up, you have good credit, and you can literally afford, literally, dollar-wise, to purchase a piece of property, it is a fabulous time to buy. Unfortunately, you know, we do have a lot of foreclosures. It's a lot of product on the market, which enables ones that are qualified and prepared to take the step. They have a vast array of product available to them.
What about auctions? Are they a good idea for people who may not be experts to really look into?
With the auction scenario, you do need to do your homework. You need to know what you're getting into. You have to walk in with money that you're willing to spend, and you have to do your due diligence on the properties, because you have to know where your limit is and what you're willing to pay to get that property.
All right. Well, Nancy, thank you.
You're welcome.
Nancy Harris owns Harnon Financial Group in Los Angeles. The group helps people locate, finance, and buy property. She also blogs about financial issues at harnonloans.com. And she was with me at our NPR West studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. 49 years ago, Clarence Garrett dropped out of college so he could make money to raise his four children. Then, once he was in his 80s, he decided not to let his dream slip away. In 2006, he enrolled as a full-time student at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. In December, he finally graduated more than half a century after his journey began. I got a chance to talk to Clarence Garrett not too long ago. First, he took me back to his childhood in segregated Baltimore.
When I was a boy, I was the worst thing you could possibly think of. I didn't want to go to school, a hook school. I was a terrible boy.
Terrible as in mischievous? What kind of terrible?
Wouldn't study my homework, cut school, you know.
What changed your mind? Because you did start college for a while.
Well, ever heard of the three C's? Civilian Conservation Corps. That was started by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, at the time the President of the United States. And he started that program to get young boys like me off the street and try to put them in places where they could learn a trade. And I joined that, and that's when I started to learn about gasoline engines, diesel engines, and heavy equipment.
That probably served you pretty well when you went into the military. How did you get into the military, and what did you do once you went in?
After I left the CC camp, I went to the Norfolk Navy Yard in Portsmouth, Virginia. That's where I learned to run engine lathe and made parts for ships. And I wanted to volunteer for the Army, but I was drafted. and drafted and was sent to Camp Ellis, Illinois, where I take my basic training and went to overseas in a quartermaster service company in Germany, first France.
What was it like in the military? You mentioned that you were in segregated schools. How did people of different races get along in the military when you were in?
There was no such thing as a mixed company. And the companies that I were in at that time were all black, and they had white officers. Of course, you could still see the segregation in some of the fellows that were from the South. You know, that I recall one incident in Frankfurt, Germany, where during the mess period, this was a sergeant first class, and he was sitting at the table dining, and I went to get my tray, and to come to sit down at the same table, he looked at me and said, "There's other seats elsewhere." I said, "You mean to tell me, man, you come all the way over here and want to start that crap?" And we got into a confrontation when we got outside. I didn't strike him, but I was waiting for him to strike me. And if he did, all hell would have broke loose.
So you were ready to stand up for yourself?
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Do you ever talk to the students that you went to college with recently, students who were maybe sometimes 60 years younger than you, about what you have lived and what you have gone through? Do you ever tell them these kinds of stories?
In some of my classes, some of the fellows would ask me about the segregated South. I would reveal to them, like in one instance, we had a history major, and he was just tickled to death to learn this stuff firsthand from somebody who had actually been through it. Example, I used to tell him that at the Norfolk Navy Yard, the drinking fountains and the laboratories were all segregated, black colored water and colored bathrooms, white bathrooms. And the white water always broke down and they drank the colored water.
All right, let's flash forward a little bit to what your life was like. You had served in the Army and then the Army Reserves, and you began school classes, but you dropped out to help your family. Did you ever feel, wow, I have missed my chance?
No, ma'am. I never felt that way. You know, having the kids and you wanting to be educated, knowing what it is like to be not educated.
Did you ever think, I'm going to be older than most of the professors, let alone the students? Did you ever worry about that?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. To be honest with you, when I was in class, I thought I was young as the youngest student there. I just enjoyed myself immensely. I felt not out of place. I felt in place, and we got along just like peas in a pod.
What were some of the challenging parts of school? What did you find the hardest?
Reading, studying my lessons. You know, because I had to read more, you know. And, of course, you know, as you get older, your short-term memory sort of fails you once in a while. So to make sure that you got the material where you could reproduce it, you had to study a little harder and do a little more research.
So tell me what graduation day was like.
Ooh, the best day of my life, I guess. Life doesn't get any better. Life doesn't get any better. With my family there or my friends cheering me on, I felt like I was 16 years old. What a day, what a day! I was happy. Everybody was pleased. They gave me a good ovation. I really enjoyed it. I really did. I cannot explain to you in words my feelings.
So if there's somebody out there listening, and I'm sure there are people who are over 70 or over 80 and who have thought, well, I'd like to go back and pick up that extra degree, but I don't know if it's practical, why would you tell them that it's something that's good to do?
First thing, why would it not be practical? If it's something someone wants and something they have missed all their lives and they know as they're getting older, that they're getting closer to the end of the line as something they want to do before they pass on. You know, you didn't come here to stay, and you will perish. So if that's the last thing you wanted to do, then I should do it. But first I want to remind you that you must have good health, you must have good stamina, and the interest has to be there. If the interest is not there, forget about it. You're wasting your time.
And as far as health goes, what's your best advice for how to stay healthy?
First, I would like to say I have never had a headache in my life. I don't take no medications for nothing. All my vital signs are good. You have to pay attention to what you eat, not eat too much fat. Watch your salt intake. Watch your alcohol intake. Stay away from drugs and smoking.
Well, that's good advice all around. Thank you, Mr. Garrett.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
87-year-old Clarence Garrett is the oldest graduate in the history of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Fans of R&B and soul music, get ready to cheer. After 4 years away, Layla Hathaway is back on the music scene with a new CD, Self-Portrait. Just for those not familiar with Layla, yes, she is the daughter of soul legend Donnie Hathaway. But this velvet-voiced soulstress has her own unique style. Layla, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So it's been 4 years since your last CD, Outrun the Sky. What did you do during those 4 years? Were you performing? Were you writing songs? Both?
I was doing all of that. Playing with the dogs. Trying to find a place to let me make the record that I wanted to make. I think a lot of times performers take time off, and it's not that they took the time. They're not really kind of chilling out on the beach. They're just trying to find people to sponsor their habit, which is making music.
A habit. That's a funny way to describe it. Why do you use that word?
Well, it just occurred to me in the last few months that what I do is almost like a drug for me. If it's not there on some nights when my instrument is not working correctly like I want it to, or the sound isn't right, or the audience is heckling me, or somebody's not happy, it's almost like I'm not getting that fix that I need. And it is kind of the biggest drug in my life is taking music to people in a way.
So, Layla, you have a bunch of different sounds on this CD, and let's talk a little bit about the song 1 Mile, which has a little bit more of a hip-hop R&B edge.
All around the world, tell me I'm the only one. They believe you love me so. Certain how you let me down. Tricky how you said the words. I didn't even feel disturbed. You're my one and only girl. Those are only words I heard.
So when you think about the storytelling and the sound, mm-hmm. How do you cross-pollinate them when you put together something like this song?
It's really kind of an organic process for me. I mean, when I was growing up, you could have a record like a Chaka Khan record. It may have a Beatles cover, a duet with Rick James, a bebop medley of all standards. All of that stuff could coexist on one record. So in my mind, growing up, I learned that the musician was the thread through the record. So no matter what the beats dictate, no matter what people say the genre is or whatever it is, that the music has to be consistent and I have to be consistent.
When you think about how other people perceive you, I want to quote something back to you. Garth Trinidad, host of Chocolate City on the LA NPR affiliate KCRW, which podcasts all over the world, said, quote, "Layla continues to fortify her legacy as a modern day vocal priestess."
Wow.
Yeah. That's hot. Yeah. Do you believe the hype when people say good things, or do you get upset when people say bad things?
I don't. It's kind of like reading my horoscope. The ones I like are true. That's how. That's kind of how I do it. I appreciate that. That's a lovely thing to say, and it's very regal, and it's a beautiful thing. So I don't believe much of the hype. I do believe that, you know, I have a gift, and I've been put here to do that. And so it's a cool thing when somebody thinks highly of you and they say nice things. It doesn't keep me from being on the grind, though.
Being on the grind, what does that consist of for you? I mean, well, like in terms of what?
Being on the grind, sleep until noon, you know.
Yeah, that's being on the artist grind.
You know,
but I know you're a hard-working sister.
It doesn't keep me from pressing forward, trying to learn about music, trying to make my craft better, trying to improve my instrument, trying to figure out even more things that I can do that maybe the next singer can't do, finding out what's unique about me, trying to find out a better way to enhance my tone, all that stuff.
Well, let's play a little bit more of your new CD. The song is called Little Girl.
Flashback to a Midwest town in a time of renaissance. An innocent child, Saturdays and Soul Train. Music feeds a budding mind, painting glory on your FM dial.
We have to ask about your father's legacy. Donny Hathaway, complete musical legend. Do you think it was a pro or a con to be born into a family of musical legacy?
It's hard to say, and I tell people, you know, I'd have to go back and do it again the other way to know. It has never been a hindrance as far as I can tell. I know that people have tried to apply gentle but firm pressure, and it's just not anything I've ever allowed to really influence me in that way. It's just a part of who I am in the same way that I am my mother's daughter and my cousin's cousin and my aunt's niece.
How do you think it changed you, if at all, to lose your father when you were so young?
How did it change me to lose a parent?
Yeah.
Oh. Do you have both your parents?
Nope.
Yeah.
Father has passed on.
Yeah. It's a deep question. I mean, I don't know if you've ever answered it for yourself, but it's one of those questions that doesn't really have an answer.
Mm.
You could answer it. It changed me 100%. It's one of those things as you grow up, period, without a father, it's a really hard thing, particularly for a girl. It sucks. It's one of those things, and fortunately or unfortunately, because of what I do, I'm forced to deal with it in such a way that I have to talk to people about it occasionally. But when you lose someone that's so vital and alive to everyone, they never really leave. So I'm still, 30 years after the fact, talking about my dad probably at least once a day in terms of, like, it almost just happened. So it's kind of a deep concept.
Yeah. I can imagine that sometimes when people like me ask you about it, you're just like, I don't want to talk about it.
Well, it's not that I don't want to talk about it. It's a hard thing to talk about, which is part of the reason why I chose to make records for a living and make music for a living, because it has been my therapy and my catharsis to be able to really put it out there on a record, you know? But because I do what my dad did, and it's so freaky, it's just always, he's always alive and always with me. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. What do you think is the state, and this is one of those grand questions that probably also has no answer, as you pointed out about one of the previous questions, the state of Black female singer-songwriterhood? And I'm thinking about people like you, Jill Scott, India Irie, Angie Stone. There are some really strong people out there. But do you think it's a good time to be a Black woman singer-songwriter?
Well, I got to, or I'm doomed. I do think it is a good time for independent artists, period. And I feel like soul music in this country really has told the story of Black Americans in this country. And right now, the field is kind of narrow. So from city to city, you go and you listen to the radio, and you're trying to find soul music on the radio. You're either listening to hip-hop, or you're listening to oldies and dusties and R&B. So there's a whole big, huge chasm, which some of us live in, part of the time at least, where is this music? Where is the new soul music? Where are the people that are writing the classics that are going to be around in 20 years and 30 years and 40 years?
Well, in addition to your own songs, you have sung other folks' work. And in 2004, you sang on a tribute album for Luther Vandross. Mm-hmm. Here's a little bit of Forever, For Always, For Love.
Do. Love that we once had.
If I had the chance to love you again, I would make your heart forget I was ever there.
I still miss him.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's hard.
He had a very special place in the music pantheon.
He really did. And those people live forever.
Absolutely.
People like Marvin Gaye and Donny Hathaway and Nat King Cole and Luther Vandross. That's why we say the late great. And people used to say that about my dad. And I only heard it about Daddy, you know, the late great Donny Hathaway. And I say it about Luther as well. You know, it's such a void created that'll never be filled again.
Finally, if you were to meet some, let's say, junior high school student who said, I want to be a singer-songwriter, what would you say to them?
I would tell them to listen to as much music as possible and go back as far as you can go and listen to music because it's going to make you a better musician.
Well, great advice. Layla, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was singer-songwriter and producer Layla Hathaway. Her latest CD is called Self-Portrait, and she was with me at our NPR West studios. You can watch a video of this interview online on our News and Views blog.